coming up on today's Compassion Radio.
All these people come flooding through Turkey. Turkey doesn't want them. They push them out. Hungary and other countries in Eastern Europe think, oh, that's just a bunch of Turks coming at us.
They don't want them.
They don't want them. So they were kicking them out and treating them quite poorly. It was so bad that it was against the law of their own country and the law of the EU how badly they were mistreating the people coming through their country to the point where people were being beaten just for trying to run away.
Today on Compassion Radio, we're going to turn the tables just for a minute. And I am going to spend some time talking with Bram about an experience that he had a few years ago when he was able to visit the refugee camps on the island of Lesbos, Moria, which we've heard in the news recently has burned completely to the ground. So, Bram, welcome to Compassion Radio.
Happy to join you on today's broadcast.
Before we go into your visit to that particular camp, why don't you talk a little bit about what you know, the history of the boat lift that was happening there between Turkey and the Greek islands, where all of these refugees from various countries around that part of the world were flooding into?
Like pressure releasing off the side of a hose that's overpumped. Think about how many refugees were trying to walk their way to Europe for years during the height of the war in Syria, Kurdistan, southern Turkey, northern Iraq. Ever since the collapse and the rebuilding and then the collapse again of the Iraqi government, it's just been downhill. But it's not been an easy road, literally, for those who are trying to escape the violence. You would run from one country to the other and be stuck in a new round of violence. And then, of course, when Syria collapsed after the Arab Spring, you had hundreds of thousands of people that had nowhere to go. So they were marching across. At that time, it was Turkey getting to the European side, people borrowing boats to get across the Bosphorus, which is the artery between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. It's a river that's quite wide in some spots, but not as wide as going across the ocean. That's how they were getting to Europe, and then walking on from there through Serbia, through Croatia, eventually ending up in Germany, Denmark, and England.
And we met some of those refugees in Serbia when we were there in 2019.
We did. In 2017, the focus had shifted a bit to what was happening with the boat lift coming out of Turkey and Syria directly to Greece and the Mediterranean, because Turkey had worked out a deal with the EU to cut off the borders. And now all of these people groups that couldn't get out to Europe by walking were having to find a boat to go across the sea. And most of these people are not seafaring peoples. They discovered pretty early on that what was going to happen was more than dangerous.
Do you think that they wanted to shut that land bridge, if you want to call it, or that land route off to dissuade them from coming?
I'm certain that most of the European governments at the time did not want to be stomped over by hundreds of thousands of refugees. And Hungary especially was quite anti-immigrant and quite racist because of the history that the Austro-Hungarian Empire had in fighting the sultans of Turkey before World War I. They just have this mentality that everybody who is Arab or who is Muslim must be a Turk. And so they just hate them. They've been trained to hate that empire. So all these people come flooding through Turkey. Turkey doesn't want them. They push them out. Hungary and other countries in Eastern Europe think, oh, that's just a bunch of Turks coming at us.
And they don't want them.
They don't want them. So they were kicking them out and treating them quite poorly. It was so bad that it was against the law of their own country and the law of the EU how badly they were mistreating the people coming through their country to the point where people were being beaten just for trying to run away.
Wow.
Then they closed the borders off hard. Physical barriers on the borders to prevent as many people as possible from making it into Hungary or into Austria. They were shunting to the west and going through the Balkans. And then, of course, they shut all that down. You still had this onslaught of people running for their lives because there was no water left. There was no food. The wars were still raging in Syria and in northern Iraq. And Jordan was overflowing with refugees, and so was Lebanon. And now they have to find some other way to get out. And so the only way to do that was to hire what we would consider coyotes here in Americas to do the dirty work of getting them across the sea from Turkey to Greece. And Greece, of course, is mostly an archipelago of islands, and many of them are quite close to Turkey. So the journey across the sea might only be 15 or 20 miles. But if you've never been on the ocean, period, that's still an astounding distance to try to go. And for the most part, people from the Middle East don't know how to swim either.
Well, and we're talking about small boats. These are not large yachts or ocean liners that these people are packing into. They're relatively small fishing boats is what they are.
And the people smugglers were being hired to take people across the channel as they go back, pick up another boatload and go across again. The EU put a stop to that, saying if you are bringing people across, they're refugees. If you go back, you're a smuggler.
Mm.
In order to continue the business, they had to make things disposable, put boats out on the water. But then what do you do with the pilots? If they go one way, how are they trying to get to Syria or Turkey to start the cycle all over again?
Okay.
It became apparent that you couldn't send guides anymore. They just started packing people into the flimsiest boats that were going to be destroyed when they got to Greece anyway. Pack them in as tight as you can get them, put the fuel in the tank, and then say to one person in the group, you're the captain. Just point at that island over there. Go. Mm-hmm. And they'd shove the boat off from the shore. And then by the middle of the night, while they're still in the middle of nowhere, things would get dicey. The weather might change. And they can't see a thing.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I got to Greece in 2017, they had had 3 years nonstop of boats that were wrecking themselves on the shore at night.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened was they would see a light. What they were seeing, of course, were lighthouses that were stationed along the shore. And why are lighthouses built?
Right, of course. The lighthouse is there to keep people away from the rocks that are on that part of the shore.
And identify the most dangerous place to go.
But because these people are not seafaring type people, right, they would not necessarily know that.
And over the course of like 2015, 2016, there were untold numbers of people that wrecked on the rocks.
We saw so many pictures on the news of these boats and their wreckage and lives that were lost. It was
devastating. The most famous one, of course, was the picture of that young toddler washed up with his face down in the sand. And his other family members were lost as well. But just that one image of one body washed up was just intolerable.
Right.
The pressure mounted from Europe against Turkey saying, you are creating a humanitarian crisis. You've got to do something about this. Turkey called back to Europe and said, you're doing this. We didn't start this problem. You did. You shut down the borders. You refused to take them in.
Mm-hmm.
And then you changed the rules about what it means to be a refugee. So they were just arguing back and forth. And Turkey didn't want to keep them. Europe didn't want to receive them. And there was no place for them to survive in Syria or Iraq or in Kurdistan anymore. What are you going to do?
Right.
So the decision was made that they can't keep them in the country. So they turned a blind eye to those smugglers, but said, you can't keep killing them by sending them all the way. Just get them part of the way there and then let the Coast Guard pick them up. And at least the people in the boats will be safer.
Okay.
So that was the policy that was introduced by the time I arrived in 2017. Friends, before we jump back to today's interview, I just want to remind you that Compassion Radio is a communications ministry, and it depends on the faithful support of you to keep bringing inspiring stories to the air each day. Our vision partners support us monthly with gifts large and small, and make it possible for us to take you to the very front lines of faith. Whether you join our vision team or make a one-time gift, thank you for believing in and standing by this ministry. We're here to bring you real good news in every situation. Just call us at 1-800-868-2478 to make your gift and to request our special offer this month, the CD of Michael O'Brien's marvelous Crown Him music project, as our thank you. You can also text the word compassion to 53445 to give right through your phone or visit our website, compassionradio.com. Thank you, friends, for everything you've done and what you'll do today. We love you. And now, back to the interview. Turkey didn't want to keep them. Europe didn't want to receive them. And there was no place for them to survive in Syria or Iraq or in Kurdistan anymore. What are you going to do?
Right.
So the decision was made that they can't keep them in the country. So they turned a blind eye to those smugglers, but said, you can't keep killing them by sending them all the way. Just get them part of the way there and then let the Coast Guard pick them up. And at least the people in the boats will be safer.
Okay.
So that was the policy that was introduced by the time I arrived in 2017.
So how are they just getting them part of the way there?
You load up the boat and you calculate how much gas is likely to get you all the way to the shore, and then you cut it in half. And you just do the same thing. You put somebody on the tiller and say, head toward those islands. And by the time the middle of the night hits, the gas runs out and then there's suddenly adrift. And then they open up an instruction manual that says, now call this number. And it was the direct number to the Greek Coast Guard. And from their cell phones, if they were still operating, they would call the Coast Guard and beg for a pickup. And the Coast Guard was obligated by the law of the sea to render aid.
Sure.
So now Greece is stuck with having to do all the dirty work for all the other countries and are now responsible for receiving the refugees, which they didn't want either. And now you've got no infrastructure and all of these refugees suddenly spilling into your ports that you are morally obligated to save.
Mm.
At least the refugees at that point were being saved.
Yes. So they set up camp here on the island of Lesbos.
And they set up very informal camps for a while. They were just kind of like homeless people would be trying to find a place under a bridge or a shelter in an olive grove somewhere to mm-hmm. set up for a while. The islands off the coast of Turkey are fairly arid. It's kind of like being, what we would say, a very Mediterranean climate. And by that, we mean a very dry one, like southern Spain, Sicily. So it's a very dry desert island situation. They would be able to survive most of the year until the rains would hit during the rainy season, and it would be a total washout. Big right. gullies being flushed through with floods and people being killed by flooding. So during those couple of years, they had to figure out, what are we going to do with them? Because the EU was not moving them through the country. They weren't asking them to send them off to another camp somewhere else. The Greek government was stuck with having to retool what they had, and they only had a couple of very small military bases, which had been turned into like a local jail for a while. Then it was a dump, and then they just kind of cleaned that out. And then they started letting refugees start coming into this camp, and that camp was known as Moria. It turned over the four-year period where the surge of immigrants started to become the largest refugee camp in all of the EU.
Mm-hmm.
It swelled from a max capacity of 5,000 persons to about 50,000 people the day I arrived.
Okay, so this camp was intended to house only about 5,000 adult people.
Oh, max. I mean, this is a camp that was a previous army base, okay. like for training for mm-hmm. recruits, and its capacity at the time was 500.
500.
So they had barracks that would be able to house 500 soldiers, and they repurposed those buildings and said, we can fit 10 times as many in those buildings. And the footprint of the entire camp was less than 3 or 4 acres.
Okay.
So maybe like 100,000 square feet or so of area where these barracks were, and had concertina wire, they call it, like you have around a jail or mm-hmm. prison. And they started shoving people in there. And then they realized they couldn't lock them in because they can't make a concentration camp out of it. So they had to leave the doors open. Mm-hmm. So now we have the problem of people going in and out. Discovering things are really bad in the camp and too overcrowded, they started leaving anyway. So the police would then round up all the people and shove them back in the camp and then start locking the doors at night and keeping people in like a part-time prison.
Mm-hmm.
When I got there, there were up to 48,000 people, and there were 40 different countries or so that were housed
wow.
there
yeah.
because it was the only place in the world that had a conduit for people to come through because of refugee issues. So people from Central Africa were at war, and they were finding their way on cheap flights to get to the Middle East and then doing the same walking trek that people from Afghanistan and Pakistan mm-hmm. and other countries were doing with other conflicts, just kind of join the swell of humanity going mm-hmm. through there. We keep forgetting this is not just one conflict.
Right.
These conflicts, again, are still going on. And that's the biggest issue for me, is that you've got a cascade of conflicts that the world is really not addressing yet.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I was there in 2017, 48,000 people in this camp, babies to elderly to working people, economic refugees from India and Pakistan and the Middle East. People had been stranded there from other countries, had nowhere to go. Their country mm-hmm. wouldn't take them back. You know, there was a lot of people that came from places like Indonesia or Vietnam that ended up taking jobs in the Middle East
mm-hmm.
and then were abandoned there and weren't allowed to go back to their countries. They had nowhere to go.
Right.
And there have been so many wars going on that these people were no longer welcome. And they didn't want these other Muslim people from these other countries hanging out. They got pushed into the stream of humanity.
So this is just a mishmash of cultures and
completely
races, nationalities, all of this in one place. And they have to figure out how to survive together.
And a third of them are children. I mean, people mm-hmm. between the ages of maybe infancy and 15 that may or may not be traveling with their nuclear family groups or have been sent by their family who couldn't go with them. And all their hopes of the future are hanging on these young people mm-hmm. making it somewhere to get a job and make some money.
So a lot of unaccompanied minors.
Yeah. And therefore, you got a real legal problem.
Mm-hmm.
It was a stunning experience for me being in the camp because there was so much humanity. Mm-hmm. I mean, not just people, but humanity.
Right.
The mix of cultures you're talking about, the smells of food cooking and the ways that different cultures would create something out of nothing. I mean, mm-hmm. these smorgasbords of incredible eating happening of things people had scrounged from meal kits, olives from gardens, things they were raising on the roofs of their barracks.
Mm-hmm.
There was incredible entrepreneurialism going on mm-hmm. with all of these people to pull together a society within a melting pot. Mm-hmm. Kind of like you would have in Singapore. There are big parts of the city that are Indian, big parts that are Malay Straits, others that are Chinese, and others that are Western. And they all have their own districts in the city, and they have their great festivals. Mm-hmm. Here you've got 40 countries inside of three blocks.
A lot smaller space.
But they all seem to have their own cultures going on, and they're right up next to each other. You would have people step across and go eat out at somebody else's camp.
Well, that's neat how they would open up their communities to their neighbors around them.
And make a little money on the side. Yeah. I mean, everything's kind of a gray market economy.
Sure.
There's nobody really regulating it, but you got to do something. You got to figure out how to buy soap and toothpaste and that kind of stuff.
So were these people in this camp that you visited able to get jobs outside of the camp?
If they could, as laborers, they would take the opportunity. But most of the farms around the area were fairly fallow for most of the year. They have a very short harvest season. Mm-hmm. I'm sure lots of them took up jobs doing that. And some of them were allowed the freedom to go into the city and become buskers on the street and sell mm-hmm. trinkets and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they were not encouraged to get into the economy there, because the hope of the EU was to move them along.
Right.
The quicker you can get them processed, the quicker you can get them onto somebody else's hands that had more money, the better. And mostly people didn't want to stay on the islands either, because like we had, and still have, I think, in America, rules that say feet dry, you have status legal. Mm-hmm. Boat people from Cuba, even today, can land on the shores of Florida and set foot on soil. They have a special set of rights. Mm-hmm. The same thing's true in Europe, and they call it the Schengen Agreement. Once you step on terra firma Europe proper, not just an island, but the mainland, mm-hmm. that give you the right to a judge and to a hearing and that kind of stuff. That was another one of the reasons why the main European nations did not want these refugees off the islands. They knew they would be responsible for them.
Oh, right.
So you get what they call the A card, like kind of a red color that said you actually have the authorization to go all the way to Athens and then on to other camps mm-hmm. and get a green card so you can get mm-hmm. work, that kind of stuff. So they were hoping to get them through 2 or 3 days, maybe a week or two, at the very worst, 3 weeks of interim before they could find a place to place you, move you on. And that just had collapsed by the time I got there in 2017. Well, they'd been there for up to 5 months or a year.
It seemed like because there was such an influx of people, just this mass of humanity coming into the country, that it probably was a little overwhelming to the local government.
Yeah, not just the local government, all the upstream. As our friend Jeremy, who was the camp director when I was there, would say to us, he is so impressed with Greece because they invented democracy. He's really dismayed with Greece because they also invented bureaucracy. And they literally have perfected it.
Yeah.
There are so many things that you can't get done because it's just not the way it's supposed to be done, or mm-hmm. someone's not there to take your question or your paperwork. Mm-hmm. It just goes on and on and on. So that was very helpful to those who didn't want to see any more refugees. Mm-hmm. Just keep them locked up in the system and just let Greece deal with it.
So we know at some point that all of these NGOs were basically removed from these camps and kind of kicked out of the country.
Yeah, let's talk about them for a couple of seconds. The NGOs that were there to help were some of the most enterprising and well-equipped and mm-hmm. trained groups in the world. These Euro relief groups that were involved directly in the camps to start with were people that were trained by the UN and had been active in all the major famines across Africa and Asia for the past 20, 30 years. They knew their stuff. Mm-hmm. And they trained up young people to go out there and actually serve in the camps. They were running out of resources because the governments would stop sending the money to backstop them. Mm. And the donations were drying up from those that were supporting them and Christian communities throughout Europe and in Scandinavia. So they were tight. And then the Americans arrive and step in and sistered up their work with them. And that's how Jeremy Holloman, our friend, ended up becoming a senior camp director at Moria. Eventually, those agencies all collapsed and had to leave, and he was left holding the bag. He was also left holding the bag of all the other employees. Mm-hmm. So all these other people that had come there to do the work had no funding, but they wanted to continue doing the work. So Jeremy had to figure out how to supply for their needs and raise enough money from private sources back in America and other people in Europe that were aware of what he did to work with Conscious International, which was our friends, Jim Jennings and his crews. And he didn't know how he was going to be able to put that budget together. And that's one of the reasons why Jim Jennings had asked me to go with him that year to see what was actually happening so we could tell that story then. Mm-hmm. Jeremy had managed to wrangle everybody who was left. And the biggest contingent of volunteers there were the Mennonites in northeastern America. And the Mennonite Church in America and the Brethren Church has sent a whole bunch of volunteers. And there was a whole contingent of people that were part of the World Race Teams,
right,
which is one of the projects of Adventures in Missions, AIM, out of Georgia. And there were, you know, teams around the world doing all kinds of projects, and Moria was one of the biggest needs, so they kept sending teams through every month to help out with that before they moved on to their next project.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to meet lots of those great kids that were predominantly North American. When you got people from 5 or 6 or 10 different nationalities trying to serve together, a group of people that is in the tens of thousands that represent 40 to 45 countries, you can imagine the complications every single day,
right,
trying to figure out where to put people, how to feed them, how to clothe them, how to get them registered, how to help them with their paperwork, how to get them ready for the trip to the mainland once they were received by a refugee agency that could help them locate a place to go.
Well, the language difference alone, yeah, would be overwhelming.
They were constantly recruiting interpreters, people,
mm-hmm,
that knew enough of the languages. And sometimes I watched them do a hopscotch through 4 or 5 different languages in order to get the message across to the person at the end of the chain. So if you think of the game of telephone as bad enough, you know, just trying to get a message across. Imagine doing telephone
languages
through a number of different languages. I mean, you and I used to play around in the early days of the internet when Google Translate came out. We kind of put famous quotations through a bunch of different dialects and languages and see what came out the other end just for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of like that in the camp, but it was serious, dead serious business,
right,
because,
right,
some people's lives were at stake here.
Absolutely.
And getting it right was really crucial. They had to have a huge amount of grace for each other and a huge amount of good humor,
mm-hmm,
to be able to laugh through all the craziness that was part of this.
Mm-hmm.
That was the camp that we walked into as Compassion Radio with Conscience International and said, okay, what's God up to?
Mm-hmm. And many of our listeners rose up and
they did indeed
helped support and fund a lot of the projects that were happening,
right,
over there, and we are so grateful for that.
Sandy and I will be back for more of the story on tomorrow's program.
This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings and round me rings the music of the spheres. This is my Father's world, I rest me in the thought of rocks and trees and skies and seas, His hand the wonders wrought. This is my Father's world, the birds their carols raise, the morning light, the lily white, declare their Maker's praise. This is my Father's world, He shines in all that's fair. In the rustling grass, I hear Him pass, He's speaking everywhere. This is my Father's world, oh, let me never forget that through the wrong seems oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my Father's world, the battle is not done. Jesus who dies shall be satisfied, and earth and heaven be one. This is my Father's world, the birds their carols raise, the morning light, the lily white, declare their Maker's praise. This is my Father's world, He shines in all that's fair. In the rustling grass, I hear Him bass, He's speaking my Father's world, the birds their carols raise, the morning light, the lily white, declare their Maker's praise. This is my Father's world, He shines.
Compassion Radio depends on the faithful support of you to keep bringing inspiring stories to the air each day. Our vision partners support us monthly with gifts large and small and make it possible for us to take you to the very front lines of faith. Whether you join our vision team or make a one-time gift, thank you for believing in and standing by this ministry. We're here to bring you real good news in every situation. Remember, friends, your giving this month doesn't just support this unique media ministry. Every dime beyond our baseline budgeting is going to support the relief and rebuilding efforts in Beirut, Lebanon, led by wonderful Christian ministries already on the ground and doing tremendous work. I strongly encourage you to give above and beyond this month so we can make the most impact possible. Just call us at 1-800-868-2478 to make your gift and to request our special offer this month, the CD of Michael O'Brien's marvelous Crown Him Music Project, as our thank you. You can also text the word COMPASSION to 53445 to give right through your phone, or visit our website, CompassionRadio.com. Thank you, friends, for everything you've done and what you'll do today. You can reach me directly at the following address, BramFloria@CompassionRadio.com. However you reach out, know that we're in this ministry and this work for you and because of you. Just call or write us today to help keep us on the air and in the field. Again, the number is 1-800-868-2478. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 2770, Orange, California, 92859. And jump in anytime at CompassionRadio.com. We're waiting for you, friends. Hop on board.